Jesus, I surrender all to Him. I freely give. I will ever love and trust Him in His presence. I surrender, make me Savior holy thine. Let me feel thy Holy Spirit, truly know that thou art mine. I surrender all to Thee, my blessed Savior, I surrender all. All to Jesus I surrender, Lord, I give myself to Thee. Fill me with Thy love and power. Let Thy blessing fall on me. I surrender all. I surrender all. Savior, I surrender all. I surrender all. I surrender all. All to Thee, my blessed Savior, I surrender all.
Well, welcome. You don't have to have me that loud, though. That's overwhelming. All right. I don't like the sound of my own voice, so that's great. Well, welcome to our Equip class. For those of you who have been here for some time, we've been doing these for about the last 4 years, where we meet on Wednesdays, and we kind of discuss different topics than what we usually will discuss on Sunday. So in these classes, I think this is the 7th or 8th one that we've done. We have addressed homosexuality in the church. We have talked about how to study your Bible and gone in depth on that. We've done practical work on marriage. We have done kind of a deeper theological study through the London Baptist Confession. And so you can see it's all over the place, right? It's just kind of what we feel like are the important things that we should be addressing at any time. So again, it's different than what we do on Sundays, which is why I moved the podium over there. So it's, you know, it's a little more loose, a little more, anyway. What we're going to do today, though, is look at the issue of how the church and the culture relate. And the reason why we're doing this is because the last year has been quite divisive. If we're honest, it's been a dumpster fire. Got it. All right. Right, there's so many things for us to disagree about, and we know that if we look around, everyone is disagreeing about everything, and they all seem to be coming at us like at the same time. Like, we haven't finished one thing, and the next thing comes, and we haven't really finished that, and the next thing comes, and our whole society seems to be at war with each other, and it's not any different for the church. Right, over the last year, every pastor that I have talked to says that this is the most difficult year that they have ever been in the pastorate, with many of them actually stepping back and no longer doing this. Now, in some ways, this makes sense, right? If people are fighting, if people are disagreeing, people in the church are just people, they also will be disagreeing. But some of the conflict in the church has actually had a different dimension to it. Because the difference is that in the disagreements in the church, they're not just about where people land on a specific topic, but how the church should respond, or how a Christian should respond. And so many of the disagreements were layered with kind of Christian moral responsibility. And so it wasn't just about two people disagreeing or coming to different conclusions. Instead, the statements became, the church needs to take this position. Or if you are a Christian, you have to think or vote this way. And so there's this added weightiness to everything, because people are implying or outright stating that your salvation was in question if you disagree, that you are sinning if you don't take a prescribed action. And I'll just say, I know this element exists because I've had it hurled at me. I have been accused of not being a real Christian or not understanding my Bible more times in 2020 than in my entire life as a pastor up to that point, and really probably my entire life up to that point. And so we have to ask, what is going on? What is at the root of these disagreements? And I say what is the root of many of these internal debates within the church is a difference in how we see the relationship between the culture and the church, right? What role Christians play within the larger culture. Now, often, you probably can't even see that on there. The people online can probably, it's real clear. But the point is this, often the arguments are happening out here on the peripheral, right? These results, the things like abortion, Black Lives Matter, right? Masks, you know, all these things that we hear arguments about all the time. And yet where the differences really lie are in the core beliefs. And we're never going to be able to come to any conclusion as to why we are differing out here until we understand the worldview where these differences derive from. And so that's what we're going to be talking about for the next 4 weeks, is we're going to be talking about the worldview differences, the core differences of how we view the relationship between Christ and culture. Today we'll set the stage for that. We'll get an idea of what our goal is in this series and how we plan to get there. The next 2 weeks we're going to look at some different ways of thinking about the relationship between Christ and culture. And then in week 4, we're going to talk about what to do with this information. How do we actually use this? How do we process with this? How do we then work together? And how knowing these things can help us be better disciples and neighbors. And so our hope is at the end of this, not that we agree on everything, right? Because we still are going to be coming from some different places. But instead that we learn how to disagree better. And so I want to start by shifting the goalposts. One of the buzzwords that has become big, right, that you hear all the time whenever people are talking about kind of conflict and differences is the word empathy. This is a word that's been around for a long time. Next slide. Slide guy. Okay. It's been around for a long time. Man, you really can't see them on this screen. This is looking from 1900 up until now, the usage of the word empathy. Right about where it starts to go up is, I don't know, 1950, 1960, I think. But just over the last 20 years, you can see it shoot up. All of a sudden, this has become the thing that is going to solve our problem. If people develop more empathy, we'll all be able to get along and everything will be better. Now, people mean different things when they talk about empathy. right? Some people mean understanding people better. This is the idea of walking a mile in another person's moccasins, right? That what we need is to be able to see the world from another person's perspective. Some people, when they think of empathy, that's what they're thinking about. Other people talk of, or think about sharing the feelings of another person. This is where we get the term empath, which is a person who feels another person's pain. Now, for most people, the term empathy means something kind of a mix of these two things. It means some level of understanding with a dose of emotional involvement. And I'll just say, from the beginning, as I started hearing people using this and kind of saying, this is what we're doing, this will solve our problems, this is the goal, I've been very wary of making empathy the goal. Now, the reason is not because I don't think the world would be a better place if we understood one another or that we were deeply concerned or cared for one another. My hesitation is that I don't actually think that we can accomplish it. And it's unhelpful to give people a goal that they can't actually do. And let me explain why I think that aiming at empathy is unhelpful. First, to assume that you can effectively put yourself in another person's shoes requires massively simplifying other people. Every person you meet is who they are because of millions of variables that you do not have access to. Right? There's a complex web of relationships and experiences that go into making up who a person is and what they believe. My wife and I were talking about this week on her brother's, what would have been her brother Samuel's 31st birthday. My wife Esther has a brother who is stillborn, and that is an event that affected her family deeply. But it wasn't just that his death had a profound effect, but that person and that personality wasn't there in their growing up. And so that's what we were talking about. We were thinking about all the different ways that the family would be different, that the siblings would be different, had there been another person growing up with them in the household. Right? And how we can't even know how it would have changed all of their lives. That one variable had the potential to have such a profound effect. Of course, our lives are filled with millions of such variables, some obviously more consequential than others, but all playing a role in who we become and how we think. And so when we assume we can understand another person's perspective, we aren't taking seriously the complexity of other people. For this reason, I've always felt that setting empathy up as a goal is setting us up for failure. It pushes us to try to do something that we can't actually achieve. But I wouldn't be talking about it if it was just a fool's errand, if it was just something that kind of we can't do. No, I bring it up today because I believe that the pursuit of empathy is part of the underlying problem with us living in harmony. And one of the reasons for this is that empathy in practice actually makes people more self-centered. Now, bear with me here. In an article from Psychology Today titled Empathy is a False God, Dr. Robert Berezin points out that in attempting to feel what another person feels, we actually end up reading their story through our own. We actually end up trying to put ourselves into their lives. This is how he says it. He says, in reality, empathy is actually projective self-involvement. This is actually a form of narcissism that passes as caring. The real caring item is best described as responsiveness. Responsiveness is a process of emotional receptivity by which one is directly tuned into and involved with the other person with no reference to oneself at all. It does not involve identifying with the other person. Now, that sounds a bit harsh, and that article has been disagreed with quite heavily by a lot of people. But notice what he does. He doesn't blame people for being bad at empathy. He's saying we have no choice but to filter their experience through our own understanding. In order to make sense of what someone else is feeling, if we're supposed to meet them on the level of emotions, we have to connect it to our own feelings. We have to. And in doing this, we make their feelings about ourselves. Now, the alternative that he gives here is called responsiveness. What is that? Responsiveness is hearing what the other person is saying without feeling the need to connect to it or even reference yourself at all. It's listening to hear and to know the other person better rather than so that you can somehow involve yourself in their suffering. Now, what he calls responsiveness, I believe, is what the Bible calls humility. Humility doesn't require you to fully embrace or get where someone is coming from. What it means is simply getting yourself out of the way. In Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 5, Paul challenges the church to live in humility. He says it this way: "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others." And so in this, he calls us to do two things. He calls us to count others more significant, and he calls us to look out for the interest of others. Right? Set aside your own ideas for a moment in order to actually be able to see people for who they are. Not only that, allow for there to be differences. Now the challenge is, Paul actually says this right after saying, this is one verse earlier, "Complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind." And so in some ways we go, there's a disconnect there. He seems to want them to be a one mind while also humbly recognizing that they are different. And I would say, yes, that's humility. We gather around our shared need of Jesus in celebration of his salvation while not trying to take away any of the differences that exist between us. Unity does not require sameness on everything, only on the ultimate source of our hope. And the strength of this oneness, what we have in common, allows us to have differences and disagree and, again, argue and debate, but also still having, while also still having unity. This was pointed out well in a blog post titled "The Enticing Sin of Empathy," which is one on a series on compassion from Desiring God. Now, before I read this, let me warn you: it's written in the style of Screwtape Letters, and if you've never read Screwtape Letters, what that is it's written. Two demons talking to each other is basically what's going on. And they're explaining how to undermine God and how to attack his creation and ruin it. And this is what he says in regards to empathy. He says, "As in many things, we must always keep in mind the enemy's goals," enemy being God, and ours. "The enemy aims to produce a fellowship of sufferings with his accursed son at the center of it. But fellowship requires fellows. That is, it requires distinctness. Fellows say, 'We are together, and yet I am still I, and you are still you.' This is a kind of union where one thing is united to another thing while still being itself. In fact, if the enemy is to be believed, creatures become more themselves when thus united. Of course, it is all lies, and in stoking empathy, we are simply cutting with a grain of reality. Empathy goes beyond union to the more potent and dynamic truth of fusion, the melting together of persons so that one personality is lost in the other. Empathy demands, 'Feel what I feel. In fact, lose yourself in my feelings.'" What his point is here is the pursuit of empathy, while seemingly allowing for differences, actually ends up stifling them. It asks everyone to feel the same, to be angry about the same things, to reject and possibly even cancel the same things. Making empathy the goal makes some people end up not fitting. It sounds really good on paper, but has failed miserably in practice. Because what do you do if you're not able to feel what someone else feels? What do you do with the persons whose feelings seem foreign to you? How do you respond to someone who is seemingly not empathetic? And I would say we see this all around us. The call for empathy is unintentionally distancing people who cannot understand the feelings of one another. And so people tend to gravitate towards those people they can understand, and we start having all these little bubbles and subcultures all over the place where people are distancing themselves from people who are different than them, and all of a sudden, people can't get along. And let's be honest, this happens anyway. We are drawn to people who are like us. It makes life easier. We don't have to work through anything if the other person thinks like us, feels like us. But what we need is for this to be challenged. We don't need a goal that actually plays into our weaknesses. No, we need to set a goal that pushes us away from our desire to cut people out and surround ourselves with like-minded people. And so what we have right now all around us, and I would say in the church as well, is a culture that is more in touch with its feelings than culture has ever been before, but also less unified, and lacking any real concept of how to heal the great divides that are between us. And while there's a lot of reasons for this, I do think that healing begins with changing the goal from empathy to humility. Now, to get there, let me talk to you for a second about how you might be feeling about the conversation that we just had about empathy and humility. I'm sure that for some of you, and there's only so many here, but some of you, in the great scheme of things, pushing back against empathy in the way that I did was annoying, maybe even offensive. And there are a few possible reasons for this, right? One of the possible reasons why it could have rubbed you the wrong way is because you may be so dug in on the idea of empathy that any critique of it makes you defensive. It feels like you're going after something that I believe very deeply. Empathy has become your team, and anyone who speaks against it is from the other team and is seen as attacking. It may be that you've connected yourself to a specific person, say Brené Brown, and my comments feel like a direct attack on her personhood. How dare you? She's a doctor, for goodness sake. Right? Or it may be that you are particularly offended because there were a lot of offensive terms that I just used. Right? I quoted two articles. One of them was titled Empathy as a Sin. The other one titled Empathy as a False God. And in one of them, it actually connected the idea of empathy to narcissism, which is, that's pretty strong. Now, while I agree with the statements in their general sense, I think the rhetoric used is purposely polarizing and unhelpful. Because if you actually are trying to convince someone of something, that kind of terminology is never going to do it. Now, when people write titles, it's all about clickbait. That might be all these people were trying to do. But what it does is it feeds into what we're talking about, this pulling away, this I can't understand what you're talking about. How dare you call me those things? So to be clear, I was aware of what I was doing, so simmer down, right? Like I understand that the wording that was used was not exactly helpful. And what I want to point out with that is it's really important how we talk to one another. It's important how we listen, and we'll get to that in a moment, but it's also really important how we actually kind of categorize or think about what people who think differently than us, who we say they are. And when you use terms like that, even if you agree with the general sense of what is there, you have to know that you're not ever going to be actually drawing anyone into a conversation. You're going to be doing nothing but actually pushing them further from where you are. So our emotions are an important part of how we relate, but we need to know that they can also be manipulated. Our emotions can be manipulated in ways that prevent us from being able to ever come to unity. This is why empathy isn't a great goal, because it uses kind of the feelings and the emotion as the ultimate. And again, that can be drawn in a wrong direction. But I'm not here to demonize empathy, even though it might have seemed like it for a few moments. But I also think we need to be able to be honest about where it is leading us. As another critical article on empathy concluded, this is indeed a moral quandary, but the solution is not to banish empathy from our minds, even if that were possible, which it's not. Doing so would throw the baby out with the bathwater. Empathic concern is still vital, to the kind of care and moral commitments that motivate moral action in the first place, whether toward a single individual or toward entire groups or nations. Instead, it's useful to recognize the way that empathic, the word is empathic. Can you guys say that? Thank you. Concern can sometimes lead us to make questionable decisions so that we can guard against some of these problems while still harnessing its potential for good, right? So I don't want us to be anti-empathy. That would be ridiculous and counterproductive. But I do want to make sure that we know what our aim is and where we're going. Setting empathy as the ultimate goal leads us away from where we need to get. And we can, again, see those results playing out. What we need as a church and really as a society is humility, right? Humility to be able to interact with those we disagree with those we don't understand, with those we will never feel towards. And so the question is, how does one develop or pursue humility? Well, humility requires getting to know your ideological opponents, even though we're not allowed to hug right now, right? Right, getting to know them as people first. Caring about the person with whom you differ greatly changes how you approach the differences, right? If it's somebody that you care about and you differ on a topic, that topic becomes secondary, thirdary, fourthary to the general because you already have a connection to them. Knowing them and wanting what is best for them allows you to set aside the things that just don't matter. Second, humility means understanding them on their terms. Right, learning the best arguments for the ideas with which you disagree. Hearing the best you possibly can what they are saying. And in doing so, you might find that there are rational reasons to believe things that you do not believe. And even if they don't change your mind, even if you go, I still think you're wrong, at least you don't go, you're wrong and you're an idiot. You go, you're wrong because I think that you've kind of just followed a couple of things that are a little bit different, but you can see how they got there. They're not just ridiculous and stupid. Sometimes they're just different. Third and most importantly, humility requires knowing God. Right? There's a natural humility to knowing that you and others are creatures being watched over by a creator. He has the answer. We are not all-seeing people who everyone else is looking for to guide them. No, anchoring our disagreements to God is important because it reminds us that there is truth. Humility, and even more so empathy, can quickly fall into subjectivism, right? The belief that true knowledge is unknowable and that we shouldn't seek absolute truth. That's not helpful. No, the truth is there is a creator. He is truth himself. And so seeking knowledge is essential. Disagreeing is essential. Having arguments and debate is important. But the way that we come to conclusions on that, the way that we will ever actually come to an answer is by studying God's self-expression, right? His word. And so humility is caring about others, giving a fair listen to them, but also submitting yourself to the authority of Scripture. And this is what we're going to do over the next 3 weeks, 3 weeks after today. The way that we are going to try to expand our humility is by creating new categories to help us understand where others are coming from. Specifically, what we're going to do is we're going to look at what are called culture models, right? These are those things that are in the middle, the starting point for where we kind of begin building an idea that leads to those peripheral answers. Now, I recognize that categories are not what most people think about when they think about opening their minds up. Most people would say categories shrink your brain into putting people just into boxes. But categories and models are often seen as overly simplistic and a way to not do nothing but generalize people. And I'll be honest, they can be. Right? If you go through life and think that everything fits into a box, that everything is always just as simple as you're this kind of person, you're that kind of person, then categories end up being bad for you, right? Like, I'm sick and tired of everything left of center being called socialism and everything right of center being called Christian nationalism, right? There's a giant field in between these things, and most people live somewhere in that field. Believing that all of life fits neatly into categories is a good way to never actually understand anyone appropriately. As Richard Niebuhr, the author of the book Christ and Culture, put it, he said, when one returns from the hypothetical scheme to the rich complexity of individual events, it is evident at once that no person or group ever conforms completely to a type. So the question is, if categories or culture models are at best incomplete, why study them at all? Right? How is that going to help us on our quest for humility? Well, our brains function like a really complex computer, right? And like a computer, they have to be given some sort of framework in which to operate. They need categories in order to make sense of the world, right? Early in childhood, kids are developing all of these things. They are setting categories in the things that they're seeing, and they're doing it at an incredible rate. right? This is safe and this is harmful. This is good, this is bad. This is what success looks like. This is what failure looks like. Scary. A lot of that they get from watching us. So, like, be better parents or something. Then all of these subcategories develop underneath those big categories, right? So it's not just good and bad. Now we start getting into all of the different pieces that make up what good and bad look like. All of these layers get set up so effectively in us that we stop actually knowing what we're thinking a good portion of the time. A lot of our decision-making becomes knee-jerk and like a reflex, right? It's like a natural response based on how the world has been divided up in our brains. Now, there are scientific names for all of this, but the theological term is worldview. And the best definition I found for what that means comes from the book The Universe Next Door, written by a guy named James Sire, and he says this. He says, so what is a worldview? Essentially this. A worldview is a commitment, a fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, that we hold consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality. And that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. Now, the most difficult thing about his definition, I think, is he points out that much of what we believe and much of what guides our thinking, right, much of what actually affects the decisions that we come to is subconscious. And some of that subconscious thinking, like we're not even aware that we are doing it, is false. In other words, some of the things that we are entirely sure of are absolutely wrong. And we aren't even conscious of the fact that we believe these things. And I will say there are a lot of studies, current studies on cognitive bias that bears this out. That we come to a lot of wrong conclusions based on things that we aren't even aware that we are processing. Right, on a practical level, think of what that means for the disagreements that are pulling us apart. So many of them are based on the fact that we don't understand how we came to our conclusions, and we don't understand how anyone could possibly come to a conclusion other than the one that we are seeing. Likewise, we are unaware where we may be dismissing valid arguments based on our already developed defenses. And so we're going to be studying cultural models in order to, number one, bring some of our subconscious beliefs to the surface. Right, drawing distinctions between different approaches helps us to better understand our own thoughts on Christ and culture. In other words, we're going to talk about it so that we can think about it, so that we can actually address some of the things that we already believe that we don't know we believe. And secondly, we're going to do it to help us see some of the approaches that we have easily dismissed have merit. Categories that we can't ever imagine ourselves as a part of are rooted in the Bible. Just wait. It'll blow your minds. And the hope is that we can develop some humility through a better understanding of our own position, our own beliefs, along with its flaws, and that we can develop a better understanding of those we disagree with, along with some of their positives. Now, in order for that to work, in order for us to actually be convinced of this, we have to have good models. We have to have a good framework to work with. They have to be clear enough that we understand them and distinct enough that they highlight some of the differences in how we think of the relationship between the church and the world. And if done right, which is my job, they will help us to see each other and the relationship of church and society in a new way. Now, the classic work on this topic, and the one that this Equip series is named after, is Christ and Culture by Richard Niebuhr. I quoted from that earlier. Now, one of the reasons why this book is so important is because it was kind of written at the turning point of the relationship between Christianity and culture. It was written in 1951, and it isn't that nobody was thinking about this relationship before that. People certainly were, but this was the first time it became absolutely crucial, right? Because in America, the tension between the church and culture was just starting to shift to not be, I'll say, comfortable. Right, I mean, at that time, or as pre-1950 anyway, most people, Christian or not, agreed on the majority of moral principles. Right? We can say that society was rooted in Judeo-Christian ethic. And people will point out there were some very obvious blind spots. Yes, there were. They weren't living out a Judeo-Christian ethic perfectly, but most people mostly agreed. Coming out of World War II, this began to change. Many people will argue about the reasons why this change happened, but that's not our primary concern in this study. Instead, we'll just say as culture moved from a comfortable fit to something other, the church now had to figure out, how do I relate to the culture around me? Christians had to figure out, how do we now relate to those in the culture? And as the culture starts to, we'll say, teach very different things than what the church was teaching. And so Niebuhr's work was an attempt to summarize the ways that the church had interacted with the culture through time. He took a long view of it and said, this is kind of all the ways that the church has related to the culture in all the different cultures before now. This sort of work was being done in the academic realm quite a bit. He was the first one to bring it into and write a somewhat popular level book. Now, since his book, there have been probably hundreds, maybe thousands of books written on this topic, and many of them try to modernize the categories, feeling that his groupings are kind of outdated and that different divisions are needed as we move forward and kind of the church looks a little different, the culture looks a little different. A few of these books are James Davidson Hunter's To Change the World. He uses the categories defense against, relevant to, and purity from. So the church looks at the culture and is either defensive against the culture or feels the need to be relevant to the culture or needs to pursue purity from the culture. So the organizing principle is about the action taken by the church in relation to the culture. Another well-known book on this topic is Culture Making by Andy Crouch. That was written 11 years ago or so. He uses the categories condemning culture, critiquing culture, copying culture, or consuming culture. And so once again, you see the organizing principle is their response to the culture, how the church is going to act toward the culture. And so now you can't see that either. So basically, what I've shown is the thing I showed earlier, you have the conclusions that people come to, the things they're having arguments about, you have your core beliefs that are driving it, and then you have the actions that kind of lead you, like how you think about the action that you are putting towards the culture. What makes both of these models helpful is that they're easier to categorize and understand. And so if you look at that, if you know someone who basically is consuming and praising culture all the time, it's not hard to imagine which grouping that they are going to fit into. They're the consuming culture group. And so, again, they're easy to think through where people fit. But by focusing on action, we miss the motive. And I'll say, I can tell you to act differently. We can figure out the action side of things, but it doesn't really change the fundamental idea of what we think the relationship between Christ and culture is. And so this is just the long way of saying we'll be using Niebuhr's original order of defining the groups in this study. So while there are other ways, and we're going to be using some of those, so we'll be using Hunter, we'll be using Crouch, Keller's got Center Church, he's got his own organization, D.A. Carson has a great book, Critiquing Christ and Culture, we'll be using some of that. So we'll be pulling from a lot of sources as we go, but generally we're going to understand the relationship between the church and society in the five categories that Niebuhr has set them out in, which is Christ against culture, Christ of culture, Christ over culture, Christ and culture in paradox, and Christ transforming culture. And you don't need to know what any of those mean right now, because that's what we will be studying in the next 2 weeks. Now, while some of the other models are aimed specifically at kind of North American evangelicalism, this one really kind of, again, draws from all the different Christian traditions through time and from many different cultures. And so it gives us a much wider view than often the conversations that we are having, which I think is important as we start to talk about the differences, because more and more people are drawing from some of those other kind of models as we move forward. I also think this breakdown is helpful because it is rooted in Jesus' relationship to culture. So instead of just talking about how we should act, how the church should respond to culture, it actually allows us to go to the Bible and look at how Jesus responded to culture and how God has talked about his people responding to culture in ways that some of the others don't really allow us to. So we've talked about why we're studying this, what the goal is, how we're going to get there. I know lots of words. We're going to do just one more thing tonight, and that is we are going to define culture. Because if we're going to talk about our relationship to culture, we should probably know what it is. Now, what the culture is complicated, and it's complicated by the fact that the Bible talks about the world in numerous different ways. Right? The Bible talks about the world in a positive sense. Right? Sometimes the Bible will talk about the world as that which God created and instilled his goodness in. He is the creator. It is his creation. That's kind of a positive view of the world. Sometimes the Bible talks about the world as a neutral, kind of just, it's the place we live, right? The world is those things around you. It's the surrounding, which some people will then kind of say, it's just the thing that we need to kind of survive in order to get to the new heavens and the new earth. In the negative, the Bible uses the term world to describe the belief systems that are opposed to God, right? Worldly living or of the world. And so in that sense, world takes on and culture takes on a negative connotation. Right? Because for many people, they just take culture and slam it in there and replace the word world. Some think of it as positive, right? God's good creation. Others see it as a temporary annoyance. Others see it as a negative that we have to fight against. And in a way, the world is all of those things, right? And as we will see, the different ideas of the relationship between Christ and culture are going to affect which one of those you lean most heavily towards. Now, more broadly, culture is a set of shared practices, attitudes, values, and beliefs which are rooted in what it means to be human. This includes what we live for, what we make, and how we relate. Culture is inevitable. It will exist wherever people do. You can't live in a cultureless society. In America, we are a melting pot nation, and so our culture is quite diverse. If you ever travel the world, if you go to other cultures, there is a much more dominant culture in a lot of cultures. You go and you're like, oh, this is what this country is about. In America, while there are things that are uniquely American, right? NASCAR, tank tops. No. Sorry. You guys are supposed to help me out there. America. Heck yeah. No? Okay. Much of what our culture is borrowed and adapted from the many other cultures that people have come here from, right? And so we have taken on a lot of other cultures and kind of put an American twist on it. Again, it's why America's called a melting pot, because you throw all these things together in the pot and it melts together and you kind of have a little bit of everything. I simply say this because it's helpful to think of culture as a fabric made up of many different threads, rather than thinking of culture as this kind of single ideology, right? People tend to think like, this is what culture says, and it's like, well, it kind of depends on where you are. I remember when I was planting the church, one of the things that, this is what church planters talk about all the time, like, what's the culture of Mount Vernon? And I would be like, well, it kind of depends on where you hang out. Like, we're planting the church in the Lincoln Theater, and that's going to be very different than if you go over to, you know, West Side and you're hanging out with all the agrarians over in the farmland, which is going to be different than if you go over here. Like it's not quite as, like, monolithic as many people want it to be, which adds to the complexity of it and really our division, because we don't all agree on what it means to be human or what it means to thrive as people. Not only that, but our culture is in flux. We're constantly changing what we think those values are, and some things are becoming more important, some things are becoming less important. And so what we'll be attempting to work through over the next 3 weeks is, what is our part in all of that? Right? As things change, as people are coming from different places, as some things that we are interacting with, we can go, I can get on board with that. Other things we're going, there's no way that we as Christians can agree with that. Like, how do we deal with that? How do we fight through these things? How do we relate to the culture? How do we know what it means to relate specifically to the culture? And then as we start to look at those things, we'll look around and see why people are coming to different conclusions, because they've started at different places. They've determined a different starting point, And again, we'll be talking about that, and hopefully that helps us to understand other people better and understand ourselves better as well. I talked a lot today. Questions? There's not a lot of people here to ask questions, but that's Andrew. You don't want to be on video. You can turn it off. Yeah.